The settlement by Jews of the territory which now comprises the Soviet Union is the most ancient of all Jewish settlements in Europe. The history of the settlement of the Jews in the land which is now part of the Soviet Union is the most tragic of all the histories of Jews in Europe. In the third and fourth centuries before the Common Era, small Jewish communities were established along the shores of the seas of Azov and the Black Sea. They were part of the important Greek and Turkish commerce and merchant communities, which brought out the timber and the furs and the minerals of the Russian interior and made them available to the Mediterranean world. The history of settlement of Jews in this area is constant, but we lack a great deal of information as to the political events and activities of the day. What we do have is an intensive polemic literature directed against the Jews by the Greek and Byzantine Orthodox Catholic Church centered in Constantinople. Now, this literature, unlike much of the polemic literature of the day, is extremely bitter and vitriolic. The Jews are castigated with all types of bad names. It's a wonder that anyone would believe that such appeals would win over the Jewish people to the true faith. But there is a record of constant militant missionary activity directed by the Church of the Byzantine against the Jewish communities in the Black Sea area for the first 10 centuries of Christian existence. There's a record also of constant preaching by the abbots, by the monks, by the priests of the area to their congregations on Easter Sunday, Christmas Day, and the like, in which the Jews were accused of almost all the crimes possible to men. The record of this anti-Jewish polemic is a constant one in Russian history. It is bitter. Never in all of the history of the Russian Orthodox Church was there developed any of that tolerant, live and let live philosophy which exists between so many of the sects in the Western world. Perhaps part of this bitterness can be attributed to a startling and somewhat shocking setback which the Jews administered to the missionaries of the true faith. You remember, and I'm sure you do, your world history, beginning in the third and fourth centuries of this era, a series of barbarian hordes descended from the steppes and the wastelands of Central Asia upon the Roman Empire. And as they approached the boundaries of what was once the great Empire of Rome, missionaries were sent out from Rome, from Antioch, from Constantinople, to convert these tribes' people. And almost to a tribe, these missionaries were extremely successful. Almost to a tribe, either Arian Christianity or Orthodox Christianity won the allegiance of these barbarians. But in the fifth and sixth centuries, an important tribe numbering many hundreds of thousands of Huns descended from the steppe lands of Europe and established themselves in the area in which the Volga River pours itself into the Black Sea. They conquered and controlled much of what is today the Ukraine and the Crimea. And this group, known as the Khazars, strange to believe, converted not to the faith of the cross, nor to the new and important faith of the Crescent, but to the faith of the Torah. In the year 740, the Khagan, the king of these tribes, a man named Yulan, converted to Judaism. He and the royal family and the leaders of all the tribes and all the tribespeople. And until the end of Khazar history, sometime in the 11th century, they remained faithful and loyal to our faith. Now, we do not know what made this conversion possible. Tradition tells us that the king convened at his court a symposium of leaders of all of the faiths, an Islamic mullah, a Catholic priest, a Zoroastrian priest, and a rabbi. And the arguments of the rabbi were so convincing that he and his faith and his people converted. Economic and political historians look for other and deeper motives. And they believe that since this people was established in a buffer zone between the two great military powers of the day, the Christian Roman Empire centered in Constantinople and the Islamic Empire centered in Baghdad and Damascus, it was necessary to find a neutral religion in order that the king might bargain successfully between these two world powers. But whatever the reason, Christian missionary activity received a shocking setback in an area in which they had not hitherto been challenged, and they never forgave the Jews for that setback. They continued in the East to look at the Jews always as people who might convert the believer and the non-believer, who were competing with them actively in the missionary field, and they attacked the Jews for these activities. The Christian church looked throughout the period of Khazar domination for means of overthrowing this hated Jewish rule. Every time a local nobleman sought to revolt against the Khagan, they would support him. And finally, in the 11th century, the church plus the local lords of Kiev did succeed in overthrowing the Khazars and destroying their rule. To do so, the priests went to the poor, superstitious, illiterate farm folk in the area and convinced them of a whole litany of lies about the beliefs of the Jews, the histories of the Jews, the characteristics of the Jews, the virtues and vices of the Jews. They poisoned the minds of the people quite deliberately, quite consciously. And this poisoned mind has remained a constant among the peasantry and the serfs of Russia to our own day. Kiev needed the Jews, this new kingdom which supplanted the Khazars. They represented the one literate merchant folk on whom they could depend for all the necessary commercial and middle class activities. But the church continued its militant anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic policy. And a new word was added in the year 1116 to the language of the world, a Russian word, the word pogrom. It means destruction. For it was in that year that it, on Easter Sunday, incited by sermons in their churches by local priests, the mob erupted and attacked the Jewish homes and massacred the Jewish folk. And from that year of 1116 down to our own century, there's hardly a decade in which the Russian word pogrom has not played its devilish role against our people. Jews remain, some Jews, in this kingdom of Kiev until that kingdom in turn was overthrown by a new nomadic barbarian group, the Mongols, the very people who swept up to the gates of Vienna in 1453, who destroyed the Byzantine Empire, and who almost brought about the destruction of Christian Europe. Jews remained in Russia under the Mongols, though we know very little about them. And then in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, a new power began to develop in Russia, centered now no longer in the south, in the Ukraine, but centered in the marshlands around what is today Moscow. There the lords of Muscovy began to get first a tentative and finally a complete independence of their Mongol overlords, began to extend bit by bit their rule, the rule of their czars, over the Russian plains. And Jewish life played an interesting role in the very earliest years of the Muscovy rule, a role which we must understand if we would understand the history of the Jews in Russia under the Tsars and under the Soviets. Russia has always had a deep strain of isolationist feeling. It has always wanted to wrap itself in itself and to prevent ideas from the outside world from coursing into the lifeblood and into the minds of the Russian people. But in the early days of Muscovy, there grew up in the capital city a group of lay noble people who became convinced that only if Russia learnt the science of the Greeks and the mathematics of the Persians and the philosophy of the Arabs and of the Western European, only if they came abreast to the level of knowledge which was possible in their day, could they establish a successful kingdom. And these liberalists, a Western-minded nobleman, had only one contact with the West. And that contact was through the few Jewish merchants who annually would sail in ships from the Low Countries and Germany across the Baltic Sea to Lithuania, to the city of Novgorod, and there go overland to Moscow itself. They became very much enamored of these few Jewish merchantmen. They represented a higher degree of culture. They were all literate. Their religion seemed reasonable. Their knowledge of Western ways and Western philosophies and Western arts was eagerly sought after. And there grew up in Moscow in those days a group of people who were Judeophiles, eager to meet, to contact, to live with these Jewish merchants, to learn all that they could of Western ways. Some even went so far as to convert to our Jewish faith. But the forces of isolation, the forces of the church, the forces of the autocracy in Russia would have nothing of these Western thoughts and Western ways. They saw them as a threat to all that they held dear. And they accused and blamed the Jew for having subverted the minds of these noblemen from traditional Russian feudal ways and opened their minds to such new Western ideas as liberty and justice and freedom and human dignity and the like. And if you will, the church inaugurated a crusade both against the noble peoples who have been infected by this virus of Western ideas and against the Jewish faith, which was the agent of this infection. The word Judaism became equated with the word subversive, and it has remained such in the minds of those who autocratically and isolationistically rule Russia with the hope that they can seal Russia off from all the ideas of liberty and the like which exist in the West. The Jew became the subversive. He must be extirpated. He must not be allowed to live among the Russian folk and among who might be infected unwittingly by the knowledge that he brings. And so this Judeophile movement was crushed and blotted out. And the stamp of the anti-Jewish movement, which exists throughout Russian Tsarist days, was set. They were anti-Jewish because Judaism represented a dangerous, not only theological danger, but philosophic and political danger. The Jew represented all the ideas of the Western world of which we are so proud, and they would have no truck with these ideas. Now, the easiest course would have been for the Russian Tsars, as they established their power, to exile the Jews, to simply free the land of this contamination. But unfortunately, the Russian political structure for them made this impossible. There were the few who ruled and the many who were ruled, the few who were literate and the many who were sunk in abysmal ignorance and illiteracy. There was no middle class. But the middle-class white-collar activities of government and of bureaucracy, of education and of commerce had to be performed. And the Jew was the only person, the only group in Russia who was capable of performing these functions. And so you find in the 18th century, when various fanatic czarinas ruled on the throne, that they would one year decide to exile the Jews. But the Jews would no sooner be exiled than they had to be called back, because all Russian business would draw to a standstill. It could not exist had it not been for the talents of our people. But Russia was dedicated to the proposition that the Jews must be isolated, must be kept in separate areas, must be kept from contact with the Christian peasantry and the Christian nobility. And if possible, a new group must be educated to take the place of the Jews in this middle-class group and so make it possible for the Jews to be finally exiled. And then in one of those strange occurrences of history, the very Russia which was interested in destroying the Jewish group and minimizing the number of Jews who lived within her borders found herself, because of her territorial gains in the late 18th century, the master of the largest single Jewish population in the world. You remember that in the 1770s and the 1790s, Austro-Hungary, Prussia, and Russia three times dismembered the Kingdom of Poland. Now, the centers of Jewish population in Poland were precisely in those eastern provinces which Russia swallowed up in her eagerness for new land. 1 million Jews, probably a third to a fourth of all the Jews who then lived in Europe, became citizens, if you can call it that, of the Russian state. And Russia in the 1790s was faced with a new and unexpected problem. Her answer: to delimit the Jews to a narrow provincial area, the area of settlement in these eastern provinces, to not allow the Jew to travel from these Pale of the Settlement, as it was called, into Russia proper, to take the Jews who existed in Russia proper, who were not essential to the government, and to force them also to live in this Pale of the Settlement. And so they drew a line on the map, and they said that henceforth all Jews must live in this area, the largest provincial ghetto that the world has ever seen established. And the Jews were crowded into this rather primitive and backward part of the country. There was not enough occupation or wealth there to allow every man to be gainfully employed. It is estimated that from the year 1790 to the year 1900, some 30 to 40% of the Jewish population in this area could not find mere subsistence living. The 19th century was for the Russian people a troubled time. They knew that the autocracy, the dictatorship of the czars, based on ruthlessness and despotism, could not last. Some of the czars even attempted reforms of this system. But every time that a reform was attempted, the depth of the need for reform was revealed, and few among the ruling class were willing to go far enough in order to establish some sort of constitutional monarchy. During the early years of the century, there seemed to be some hope that the many restrictions against the Jew in occupation, in location, and the like would be lifted. Jews thronged wherever they were permitted. Some went to the universities. Some were allowed to live finally in Petrograd and in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But for the most part, bulk of the Jews continued to live in this border area between Poland and Russia, in the Pale of Settlement, and to suffer there. But a little bit of toleration which the Jews achieved in the first half of the 19th century allowed an efflorescence of Jewish culture, which is interesting as to the areas into which it developed. In the first place, there grew up not a desire for a liberalized faith, but a desire to Hebraize the faith. There grew up the Haskalah movement, the Enlightenment movement among the Jews in this Pale of the Settlement. They decided to revert to the language of their fathers, to speak Hebrew rather than Yiddish, to write in Hebrew, to express themselves in the pure language of the Bible. They began to research Jewish history, to put it on a scientific basis. They retained their orthodoxy, but they began to make it a critical study. Now, with the genius born of centuries of persecution, these people also realized, I think, that there was little hope for any permanent solution of the Russian problem. And so they channeled their political activities not so much to a reform of the government which was bearing down on them, but rather towards Israel, towards Zion, towards the reestablishment of the Jewish state. And it is important to remember that the first rebuilders, the first pioneers, the first resettlers of Zion were Russian Jews, members of the Bilu, members of the Chovevei Tzion movement, young university students who despaired of ever achieving in Russia the kind of political state which was being achieved in the West, and who saw in the reestablishment of a Jewish state in freedom the only hope of the people. And the settlements which these young peoples began in the 1840s and the 1860s have lasted in Israel to this day. And their descendants are among the first citizens of Israel in our day. Zionism represented to them the hope of the future. And they were right. Because when the Tsar Alexander II was murdered in the year 1880, the forces of reaction sprang out again in Russia. They said, look, look where all your reforms have led you. They have gotten you only the desire on the people for more rights than we can give them. And the Jews, of course, were made the sufferers beyond all others. In the year 1881 in Kishinev and elsewhere, pogroms broke out. For the next 40 years, these pogroms continued intermittently. In the year 1881, 118 Jewish communities were sacked. In the year 1882, 412. In the year 1883, 61. So goes the rule. In 1882, the Russian government announced a new series of regulations directed against the Jew, the infamous May Laws. These May Laws restricted the pale of the settlement even more than it had been drawn in the days of the 1790s. They said that Jews can no longer study in our universities, they can no longer, except with special permit, live in our capital cities. They must return to the villages, leave the towns. They must be taken out of all gainful occupation and made to live among themselves as best they can. And the Jews suffered under these May Laws terribly. And the great emigration of Jews from Russia and westward to our own country began with the 1880s, as you well know. In the 1890s, there grew up the infamous Black Hundreds, bands of aristocratic rowdies who pillaged and plundered and killed at will. Thousands upon thousands of our people were impaled by their bullets and their lances without one successful appeal for safety and security to the Russian police. It was in these infamous years that the Russian minister Pobedonostsev gave his famous formula for the solution to the Jewish problem. One-third emigration, one-third conversion, one-third starvation. And it was in those years that Plev, another of the Russian ministers, actively conspired to set up these infamous pogroms in city after city, his hope thereby to make them Judenrein, to destroy and kill the Jews. His program is fiendish as that of Hitler himself. And of course, the mind of the common people was constantly being poisoned by priests and aristocrats alike. And there's no wonder that there is a tremendous residue of anti-Jewish hate among those who have never had a chance to know any better. Then came the war. And for a while, it seemed that perhaps the blackness of midnight would be relieved by the dawn of a new day. The Jews suffered terribly in the First World War, for it was precisely that pale of a settlement between Prussia and Poland and Russia which was the battlefield of the war. Their communities were caught between the opposing armies, and each, when it was defeated in its frustration, turned and pillaged the Jewish community. But then in 1917, finally, the yoke of the Tsars was broken. The provisional government of Mr. Kerensky was formed. And the day after it was formed, it announced the lifting of all previous restrictions which had troubled the Jewish community. Jews were now free to live anywhere in Russia, to engage in any occupation they desire, to attend any school and the like. For 4 months, 5 months, the star of the Jewish community seemed on the ascendant. And then, as we well know, a new revolution shook Russia. Autocracy, despotism was reimposed upon the Russian people in the form of Bolshevism. How fared the Jews under the Bolsheviks? The Bolsheviks announced in a declaration of the rights of the Russian people shortly after they assumed power that anti-Semitism was a crime against the state. They too continued to lift all the restrictions which had previously existed under the Tsars against the Jews. There was hope. There was hope that with the lifting of these restrictions, with the proscribing of anti-Semitism as a form of governmental policy, the Jew might seriously find a place for himself under the Russian sun. And even the terrible afflictions of the Jewish communities during the wars of the 1919s and 1920s, when the white Russians and the emigres and the Ukrainian nationalists rose up in rebellion against these new Bolshevik lords, and to a man accused the Jews of being the instigators of this new revolution and wreaked their wrath upon the Jewish communities. Even despite these terrible ravages of Jewry, there seemed to be hope. And in the 1920s, it must be said that the Russian government was consistent in not permitting overt anti-Semitic activity. If they found such activity in an industrial combine, in an agricultural Soviet, wherever it might be, they extirpated it. They proscribed the man or men who were following such a policy. The West was much impressed by this official anti-Semitism. And as late as 1939, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Hewlett Johnson, the so-called Red Dean, wrote in a book, "The eternal problem of the world is the Jewish problem. The Soviet Union alone has solved that problem." But what are the facts? We who lived in the West, we Jews who lived in the West, knew that when the restrictions against our enjoyment of equal citizenship had been lifted, we did enjoy a great new day. We were allowed to enter all professional and political activity, and our faith was encouraged, or at least tolerated, along with all other faiths. But we must remember that Bolshevism is based on a religious faith of its own, and that faith is atheistic. It holds that all the traditional religions of the world are subversive to the laboring man, because all the traditional religions of the world, so it is claimed, subvert his attention from his immediate economic needs, prevent him from being the true soldier of the proletariat that he should be, preventing from crying out against the many oppressions and the yoke which surrounds him, which beats him down. Russia in 1920 created the League of Militant Atheists and went and began an intensive campaign to re-educate the religious in its people, to convince them that religion was hokum and a fraud, that they should rather put their trust in the economic materialism of communism. And this campaign of the Soviets was very intelligently planned. They saw that the one way in which a religion has of continuing itself is if it is given the opportunity of educating the young. And so the Soviets very wisely separated the school from the synagogue, the school from the church. And they said, from now on, No religious leader will be allowed to teach the young. No synagogue will be allowed to have its own schools. All must be educated secularly in schools which will, of course, teach the communist doctrine. But more important than this, only if a father wants directly to teach his son or his daughter matters of faith can these be taught. Any man who, as an official of a religion, preaches or propagates or teaches that religion is guilty of a crime against our new state. And the Jews, recognizing that education has the highest priority in the existence and the continuance of our people, created in Russia in the 1920s, as a counter to this threat, an underground system of education, underground cheders, underground Talmud Torahs, and underground yeshivas. And most of the religious teachers, the malamdim, the rabbis, became night watchmen. They would get a job as the night watchman of some important public building. And at night, they would welcome their classes and hold forth. But of course, many were not being reached. And all this was being carried out surreptitiously in secrecy and at great personal danger. And with the rise of Stalin, beginning in 1928, and especially in the early 1930s, this underground religious education was no longer tolerated. Its teachers were sought out, extirpated, or exiled. The whole system was shattered from about 1930-32 to our day. The 2 million or 2.5 million Jews of Russia have had no way in which to educate in our faith the religion of the youth. What results have this brought about? Oh, the Russians can still point to the fact that in Moscow and in Leningrad and elsewhere there are open synagogues. The rabbis and Jewish leaders who were able to visit Russia in those days immediately after the death of Stalin report that you see there the very old and the very, very young. The youth seems there no more. One man even reported that he was called over by an elder of the community who was much impressed by his visit. And he was shown a 13, 14-year-old boy, and very much like an American parent might show off the lad. He asked the boy, "Now show this rabbi from America what you know." And this 13 and 14-year-old who was conceived to know so much was barely able to recite the Shema. There has then been in Russia, in the 40 years of Soviet domination, a constant attack, insidious, covert, and overt, against the very lifeblood on which Judaism or any faith is based. They let the elders continue in the faith. They realize that they are tainted. But the young, they strip of their faith. They educate in their ways. Now in Russia, the Jews presented, in the early days of the Soviet, a very difficult economic problem. They had had no gainful employment as such, many of them in the Pale of the Settlement. The skills of the Jews were traditional middle-class skills, white-collar skills. And a Russia which was concerned with the farmer, the agriculturalist, and the working class seemed to have little concern, immediate concern, for the middle-class talents of the Jew. Now, many Jews or people of Jewish descent did find their way into the bureaucracy. For many, there were years in the 1920s and 1930s of economic difficulty and straitened circumstance. It is estimated that in 1920, less than 30% of the Jews of Russia were gainfully employed, and in 1930, less than 50%. One Russian attempt as a solution to this problem was to make of the Jew a farmer. To this end, many agricultural soviets and artels were created in pioneer areas of the country, and Jews were encouraged to settle there and to till the land. Now the Jew, when he wants to, can become a farmer. The experience of Israel has shown that amply. But in Russia, under Russian pressure, he resisted this attempt. And though by 1930, 250,000 Jews were settled on these farms, the number has since then atrophied and diminished consistently. The experiment of creating farms for Jews in Russia has been a disastrous one. Perhaps its most famous attempt was the attempt to create in Birobidzhan, a Jewish farm province or settlement, perhaps a semi-autonomous settlement. This was part of the Russian economic solution to the Jewish problem, but it became something much more. We remember that in the 1920s, Birobidzhan was seriously set out as an answer to the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. Rather, it was said, let the Jews go to this independent Soviet Jewish community in Birobidzhan, which exists at the far end of Siberia near Manchuria. There they can have their freedom. There they can settle in peace. And we saw that extreme anomaly of American capitalists, Jewish capitalists, financing the establishment of an agricultural Jewish Soviet near Manchuria simply out of their hate of the idea of the establishment of a Jewish home in Palestine. Well, this too failed, this attempt at Birobidzhan. And about all that can be said of the economic solution to the Jewish problem in Russia is that the Jews, with their usual high rate of literacy, have gone into the professions, have gone into the sciences, have gone into government, have gone into the bureaucracy as much as it has been permitted them, and they exist there to this day. But this emphasis of the Jew upon middle-class activities has redounded to his hurt. When Stalin came into power, he created in Russia more of a nationalistic state than the internationalistic center of world revolution which Lenin had envisaged. Stalin was concerned with making the Russian people united, strong against possible external enemies. And to this end, he began to play up all the traditional prejudices and hatreds and enmities of the Russian people. And there is a constant purpose which can be discerned in Stalin's activities. From the famous purge trials of 1936 and 1938, through the doctors' trials and the Slansky trials of 1951 and 52, which aims at purging the Russian bureaucracy of those people of Jewish descent who still remained there. First, the highest echelons of government were made Judenrein, free of men of Jewish descent. Even though being communist, they had long since denied any faith in the religion of their fathers. This has been constant. We have a classic example in the early 50s of a purge of Soviet Yiddish writers. Men impeccably pro-Stalinist, but men who were purged simply because they represented the Jew. And the Jew to the Stalinist, to this new Russian nationalist, represent again what he had represented to the church and to the Tsar 200 and 300 years before. The possibility of contamination through cosmopolitanism, through what he calls international Zionism, by which they mean simply that he might be the agent in which the virus of international ideas, of the Western ideas of liberalism, might come and infect the Soviet Union. Under Stalin, the Jews fared ill. He ordered that they must retain in their passport, communist and non-communist, believer and atheist alike, the stamp, Jew. And those who bear this stamp bear many discriminations. Well, these are not spoken of officially. And finally, tracing the history of the Jews in the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union has always been anti-Zionist. As early as 1913, Stalin spoke of Zionism as an agency of bourgeois imperialism, by which they really mean that Zionism commands loyalties not of an economic nature, which an economic materialistic state cannot comprehend and with which it cannot deal. They have been theoretically consistent in their anti-Zionism. Indeed, when they want to attack a Jew, they don't attack him for being Jewish. This would make them seem anti-Semitic. Rather, they attack him for being an agent of the Zionists or an agent of the what they call the Joint Distribution Committee, the agency of relief throughout that part of the world. Zionism was attacked, it is attacked, and is being attacked, especially now that Russia sees a chance to gain entry into the rich oil fields of the Arab world. But let this always be remembered as a classic example of the realism and the practicalism of the Russian dictatorship. That in 1948, when Israel was being discussed before the United Nations, before there was a state of Israel, it was only because Russia threw her whole weight behind the establishment of the state. And it was only because Russia allowed her Czech satellite to send arms to this incipient state that it was possible for Israel to come into being. Then Russia saw a chance to turn the tail of the British lion and make her roar. She made it possible for Israel to come into being. Now she argues long and loud against her existence. And perhaps if she had her way, she would wipe her off the map with an easy sock to throw to the Arab states. But then she was not so willing. A dictatorship is concerned with immediate advantage. And none of us should judge dictatorships by the theories that they proclaim or the philosophies which they seem to espouse. They are much more hard-headed than that. Now, what of Russia today? In 1953, the death of Stalin, it seemed that we might be entering into a new era. Rabbis were allowed to visit Russia. Jewish diplomats from all over the world were allowed to come there. The Israelis were allowed to reestablish diplomatic relationships which had been broken off. The Israeli youth were allowed to attend the various youth congresses which have taken place. They even allowed the rabbi in Moscow to publish a little luach, a little Jewish calendar, the first Jewish religious work which has been published in Russia in 40 years. There seemed to be some hope that Russia might be moving away from the covert anti-Judaism which was being practiced, or anti-Semitism which was being practiced under Stalin. But it has not materialized.